Hello, it's Wednesday, July the 29th. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, former Independent MP Martin Bell offers advice to Esther Ranson, who's standing as MP for Luton South.
She's going to need a lot of foot soldiers, a lot of helpers, an organisation to match the professionals.
Since the ceasefires in Northern Ireland, there are three times more so-called peace walls separating Catholic and Protestant communities.
Some of them resemble the Berlin Wall. Now, they don't have watchtowers and dogs and guards, but they some of them are the size of the Berlin Wall.
We peruse the Booker long list.
Everyone whom you'd expect to be on is on the list.
Then we get a lesson in dynamic arm swinging.
Foot goes forward and my left arm goes forward as my right leg goes forward, so it's nicely balanced.
Plus, join us at the auditions for The Witch of Wookie Hole. Before that, a news update and a paper review with Bill Overton.
Two more British hostages in Iraq are believed to be dead. Security guards Alan McMenemy from Glasgow and Alec McLaughlin from South Wales are very likely to have been killed, according to BBC sources. The bodies of two of the other men were found last month with gunshot wounds. The condition of the fifth kidnapped man, Peter Moore, isn't known. Updates on this story as they emerge on guardian.co.uk. People under 18 could be banned from using sunbeds after a new study revealed tanning devices do increase the risk of cancer. The research finds the risk is greatest to children and young adults. Experts say sunbeds belong in the same risk category as tobacco smoke. The Department of Health is now to look at new laws to protect young people. A ban on the use of tanning salons by people under 18 has already been approved in Scotland. The government's launching a campaign today to create thousands of jobs and work experience places to help young people through the recession. Around 10,000 internships and work placements will be made available for 18 to 21-year-olds who haven't been to university. Work and Pensions Secretary Yvette Cooper says, "We're determined not to lose a generation of talent because of the recession. Many young people were denied the help they needed in the 80s and 90s, ending up out of work for months and years." The pay gap between men and women in Britain has risen, according to a new report. The Women and Work Commission, which carried out the research, partly blames the government's lack of action in breaking down stereotypes in schools. It found men are paid on average 22.6% better than women who do the same job. That's up from 21.9% in 2007. Europe's poorest country, Moldova, will begin voting in parliamentary elections today. Voters face a choice between the ruling communists, who advocate Russia as a strategic partner, and their liberal rivals seeking better ties with the West. The snap election will be the second to take place in 4 months in the country. Now for a look at the day's papers, and the Times leads with news that 100 jobs at the British Council are to be outsourced to India in an attempt to save the taxpayer money. The Independent reports Britain's top accountancy firms are donating staff and resources to the Conservative Party, worth hundreds of thousands of pounds. The Sun and The Mirror lead with the case before the Court of Appeal, in which the government is challenging payments for injured soldiers. Shot in the leg, then stabbed in the back, is The Sun's take on it. Dishonour the brave, says The Mirror. Quentin Letts in The Mail says it's time to stand up for Trevor Phillips after what he calls a venomous left-wing witch hunt. In the FT, there's news house prices in America are showing their first monthly gain in 3 years. And the size of chocolate bars is to be reduced to help tackle obesity. That's according to The Telegraph. On the back pages, the papers note the defeat for 8-times gold medalist Michael Phelps at the Swimming World Championships. And Andrew Flintoff appears to be fit for tomorrow's third Ashes test at Edgbaston. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
We start today with a TV presenter who wants to be a Member of Parliament. Esther Ranson has announced she'll stand as an independent for Luton South in the next general election, in the wake of Labour MP Margaret Moran's expenses claims. Our reporter Mark Tran went to Luton to see what people are thinking.
So, would you vote for Esther Ranson?
I could do, yeah, quite easy. Because there's nothing much in the other parties to vote for, is there? I think it's time we put some more independents in.
I think it'd be a good idea. She seems to have a lot of ideas. I think she could do quite well.
Do you think she stands a chance, then?
Well, I was reading in the paper today about the guy in Norwich who stood as an independent and he polled about 950-odd votes. So whether she stands a chance or not, I don't know. But I think I'd consider voting for her.
Former independent MP Martin Bell won the Tatton seat in Cheshire in 1997 on a similar anti-sleaze ticket. We spoke earlier and I asked him what counsel he'd offer Esther Ranson.
My advice to Esther is to be very careful and prepare for a lot of disappointment. It isn't easy to stand against the candidates of the three big political parties, and indeed some resurgent minor ones. She's going to need a lot of foot soldiers, a lot of helpers, an organisation to match the professionals. So she shouldn't underestimate the risks. On the other hand, the climate of the times is ripe for an independent challenge.
Do you think she's up to the challenge? She says herself she's pretty tough.
You don't know what it's like until you start it, and then it's too late to withdraw. My view of this is that there are things you don't enjoy doing but enjoy having done, and standing for Parliament is one of them. But it's going to be a really tough, well, nearly 12 months for her.
Do you think her candidacy will reduce the election manifesto to MPs' expenses? Because that's how she's decided to go for it, isn't it?
I think it's perfectly legitimate to stand on a single issue, whether it's the closure of a hospital or MPs' expenses or the deeds or misdeeds of a particular MP. But you have to understand that if and when you get elected, you're going to vote on all issues. Therefore, I think Esther's manifesto must be very carefully drafted. So people have got to know where she stands in order to know what kind of an MP they might be getting. That's only fair.
The current incumbent of Luton South, Margaret Moran MP, she has said she will be stepping down. So Esther Ranson isn't actually taking on one opponent, is she, but almost the whole establishment. That's going to make things very difficult, isn't it?
My only reservation about Esther's candidature, I like the idea of independent standing, is that if she was going to tilt at a windmill, the windmill has disappeared from the landscape. I would like the idea where the people who should have been deselected or thrown out because of their expenses are standing again. Then in these cases, I think there's a strong argument for challenging them with what I call a local hero. That is an independent from, shall we say, Salford or somebody else with a strong local track record. And I think these challenges should be really powerful.
You yourself have been quoted as saying you're too old for politics and for journalism. Do you think age is going to be an issue, bearing in mind she's slightly older than Ming Campbell, who, of course, whose detractors savaged him for his age?
Age shouldn't be an issue. I've been asked if I'm going to stand against the next parliament, and I'm inclined to think probably no, though I'm not ruling it out, because I would by then be 71. On the other hand, Dr. Richard Taylor, the independent MP for Wyre Forest, which is Kidderminster, is 2 years older than I am. I know that because we went to school together, and he's doing fine. I don't think there are any general rules. One thing I would say, I like people with experience of life rather than people who haven't done anything but politics since they were at university.
And if she is elected, do you think she can make a difference?
She'll certainly get a lot of attention in the House. I would hope that at the next Parliament there will be at least a handful of elected independents who, of course, will not be a party but a group. They have a natural leader in Dr. Taylor. I think she can, but you never really find out until you get there. I think she's making a very bold decision. All I can do is to wish her luck in very difficult circumstances.
And there's more from Martin Bell at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. This is Guardian Daily. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, if swine flu closes schools, the BBC could be asked to clear its schedules for educational programming. Details at guardian.co.uk/news. The head of the charity Reprieve writes on Britain's rendition cover-up. guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And see the video of one of the most controversial housing estates in Britain. Find out why it's both loved and hated at guardian.co.uk/multimedia. Next, to Northern Ireland, where the number of walls dividing Catholic and Protestant communities, dubbed peace walls, has trebled since the IRA and Loyalist ceasefires. Back in 1994, there were 26. Now there are 80 permanent barriers, according to the head of the Community Relations Council in Northern Ireland. Our island correspondent, Henry MacDonald, has the story.
Well, the peace walls were first established. The first one was built in 1969, and at the time it was there to separate Protestant and Catholic areas, the Falls and Shankill Road, after nights of sectarian rioting, people being burned out of their homes. Back then they were simply barricades, buses, barbed wire set up by the British Army. Today, some of them resemble the Berlin Wall. Now, they don't have watchtowers and dogs and guards, but they some of them are the size of the Berlin Wall. And there are now 80, according to the Community Relations Council, 80 peace walls, it's a glorious misnomer, separating Protestant and Catholic communities in Northern Ireland, in Greater Belfast, in fact.
And this has been a threefold increase since 1994.
Since the ceasefires of 1994, when really the troubles effectively ended. The number have more or less trebled. There were 26 when I was reporting on the ceasefires back then, and now we have 80, according to the Community Relations Council.
And this is obviously a major increase. Do we know why?
A major increase because I think that we've had a lot of tension over the last 10 years to do with marching and parading and disputed marches and subsequent rioting during summer months in what are called flashpoints, areas where Catholic areas abut on the Protestant or vice versa. And I think really what's happened is that people have seen the kind of ghoulish success of these walls and keep giving people on either side of the line peace, if you like, or peace of mind or security. So more communities have opted to have them, basically. So there's been a communal demand by various communities on interfaces, sectarian interfaces, for give us our walls too, and that is still the case.
You use the phrase there, ghoulish success. I understand the walls are attracting tourists on so-called terror tours.
They are a ghoulish success in terms of tourist magnets. They are definitely attracting tourists. You're getting parties of Europeans, North Americans, people from further afield on so-called terror tours going up and down the Falls and Shankill Road, looking at the political murals, stopping off at key places like Sinn Féin headquarters on the Falls Road, and also visiting some of the murals. The most popular one is a mural that runs between Northumberland Street and Lanark Way in West Belfast, which cuts off the Shankill from the Falls, and it is the closest one that resembles the Berlin Wall. And just like the old Berlin Wall, people are starting to put graffiti on it. You know, in past times, pre-1989, people would write their name and on the Berlin Wall, on the western side, of course. This is now happening. People are coming up and they're saying, you know, Jürgen from Dortmund, it's a tragedy that this wall is still up, or Anna from Israel or whatever. You're getting all these type of people signing their names. And some people think it's okay for in terms of tourism, but others, including those working in the cross-community field, are quite... They're a little bit repelled by it. They think it is ghoulish. That's the word they use in terms of attracting tourists by pointing to our failures.
So do you think we're likely to see the number of walls reduce or increase further?
There's no communal demand in those areas of North and West Belfast where the majority of them are placed for the walls to come down yet. Some people have talked about a decade, maybe two decades before we see them being dismantled. So in the foreseeable future, I don't think so.
Henry MacDonald. I'm Mike Duran. Still to come on today's Guardian Daily, calling witches and wizards, Wookie Hole needs you. We've left the safe comfort of the Guardian studio offices now to walk along the canal, which is just outside. It's a lovely day. And I'm joined by our science correspondent, Ian Sample. For what reason are we out here?
Well, I thought it might be good to show you a bit about some of the research I'm writing up today, why we swing our arms the way we do when we walk. And it might seem something that's obvious to you, but that's what science is all about. It's looking at those things which are, you know, every day that we all take for granted and asking that question, do we really know why we do that? So if you look at what I'm doing, my right arm goes forward as my left foot goes forward, and my left arm goes forward as my right leg goes forward. So it's nicely balanced. Now, there was a time when people thought that the reason we swing our arms might actually be some sort of evolutionary vestige of our life on all fours, because, you know, we're swinging our arms, but they're not touching the ground, so how are they helping us? What these researchers at Delft University in the Netherlands have done is they've actually worked out properly why we swing our arms the way we do when we walk. And it turns out it saves us an awful lot of energy. If you try and keep your arms to your side as you walk along, you find actually it's a lot harder.
You look silly.
I look very silly, but also a lot harder. And it's actually, in terms of energy, it's about the equivalent of carrying a 10-kilo backpack on me or a couple of bags of shopping. If you try the maddest one, which is when your right leg goes forward with your right arm and your left leg goes forward with your left leg. Come on, try this.
Okay.
You're walking like a sort of plastic Star Wars figure or something like that. like that might. And that is costing you 26% more energy than if you just relax and walk normally.
So why are you expending more energy?
Well, if you think about it, as you move one leg forward, the leg you're standing on is being subjected to a twisting force. And every time you walk forward, the other leg you're on is twisting one way and then the other. And if you didn't have your arms to stabilize, you'd actually be wiggling around as you go forward. You wouldn't be going forward in a straight line. So if you didn't have your arms, you have to use a lot of muscle work in your legs to keep yourself going straight. It's like when you're walking on ice. You have to really tense your muscles to make sure you're not twisting around at all. But if you just relax and let your arms do that work for you, it counters the twisting of your legs.
As you started out earlier saying you don't really think about this, well,
the body doesn't. We do it automatically. So what use is this research?
Well, one thing that's probably handy about this research is that actually knowing why we walk the way we do, why we swing our arms the way we do, and the amount of energy it saves can help people improve on rehabilitation programs for people who may have had strokes or can't walk for some other reason. But there's also a definite use for this in perfecting walking robots. I mean, we think of a lot of robots running around on wheels and on tracks, but obviously we all want to see them walking around on legs as well. And this is the kind of research that will really help you nail how you do that. And also in doing it, it's going to cost, it's going to, you know, require the least energy to do it. So that means your battery power and your bills and so on for running these things is going to be cheaper.
The Booker Long List has been announced. On it are some of the literati's big names, there's a previous Nobel Prize winner, and a chimpanzee. With the details, here's The Guardian's online books editor, Sarah Crown.
There's nobody really been snubbed. Normally you have a few of the big horses who fall at the first hurdle, and in this case, really everyone who you'd expect to be on is on the list. So we have A.S. Byatt, who obviously won for Possession, back with the children's book. Hilary Mantel is here for Wolf Hall, which is her sort of a historical fiction life of Thomas Cromwell. Colm Toybin's here for Brooklyn, and Sarah Waters for The Little Stranger. And then there's also J.M. Coetzee, who's one of only two people to have won the Booker twice, and he is back on the long list again with Summertime. So yeah, no surprises, I guess.
So no raised eyebrows either?
Well, while we've got all the big names here, there are some more interesting people who've sort of crept on first-time authors. So we have probably the most interesting one of those is James Lever, who's here with his book Me Cheetah. And this is really unusual. I wasn't expecting to see this on here at all, although everyone who's read it has absolutely raved about it. And it's basically, it's a sort of the Hollywood memoirs of Tarzan the Ape, but a sort of a rewritten history of Hollywood's golden age. And Nick Lezard reviewed it for The Guardian and just loved it. And so anyone who follows his reviews will probably have picked up on it by now. That makes the list quite exciting, I think. I sort of half back that to make it through to the shortlist stage and maybe even have a shot at winning. It's a very interesting book.
Well, you rattled through some of the big names at the beginning here. Which of those do you think are worth mentioning in particular?
For me, it's got to be Hilary Mantel's novel Wolf Hall. I think she has been somebody who has been very much on the radar of the literary world for a long time. Her last book, Beyond Black, was fantastic and got rave reviews, but she hasn't really had the sort of the buying public. And with this book, because although it's a very literary novel, it's also historical fiction, which is a very well-selling genre. And so I think that it could be with this that she makes the transition into the more mainstream audience. And I thought it was just fantastic. It's absolutely brilliant. She intended it as one book and now it's actually going to be two. So we leave Cromwell at sort of the height of his powers at the end of the book. But obviously we know that he's going to collapse in the sequel. And I just thought it was wonderful, so well realised, and as you'd expect with Mantel, extremely well written. So that would be,
and well researched, presumably.
Brilliantly well researched, yeah.
So would you say that Mantel deserves to win?
Yeah, I think so.
Do you think she will win?
I hope so.
Our online books editor, Sarah Crown. And to view the full list, click on guardian.co.uk/books, where you'll also find podcasts with Hilary Mantel and Sarah Waters. Finally, around 500 mudbloods have been auditioning for a £50,000-a-year job as the Witch of Wookiee Hole. Accountants, teachers, and some just out for the day set out to prove they weren't allergic to cats and could cackle with the best of them. We sent our reporter Stephen Morris to Somerset on his broomstick to hear from some of the hopefuls.
My name is Etadandrup Dinandrod.
Oh, okay. That's a super name. Does that
mean
anything?
My mother gave it to me. It means brave as a bear.
Does it?
Yeah.
Where are you from?
From Waterford in the south of Ireland.
You come all the way from there today for this?
Yes. And my mother and my eldest sister have come with me to support me in it. The matriarchs are here.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And you've had your audition already?
Yeah, I went in the first three to be auditioned.
How'd it go?
Brilliant. Really brilliant. It was fantastic. They're doing three at a time and I saw I noticed a big camera there, so I'm hoping that I'm not face front on television. But it was great. I feel really great now.
So forgive this question, you're a real witch.
Yes.
Because I don't think everybody is here today.
Yeah.
I think some people just dressed up as witches.
Yes, they live the life of Wicca, all right. They do.
So what does that entail for people who don't know?
It means following the moons and the seasons and celebrating them. You know, the outside, you come outside and you dance and you sing. And you just celebrate it. It's all goodness. It's about sharing the goodness and then passing that forward so that other people know that there's goodness and love in the world. Because the world can be cruel sometimes.
Did you have to do a cackle?
Yes, I did.
Any good?
Yeah, I'm fabulous.
Can we hear?
My name's Alison Dyke.
How come your teeth are so black?
Oh, yes. Well, it comes from being illed and wronged in love.
Is that so?
It is true, yes. I was illed and wronged by a monk from the village. Did you not know he tried to turn me into stone? But he got my teeth first and they went coal black when I kissed him.
Really?
Yes, I was struck down by coal black teeth.
There's some tabloid reporters here who'd like to hear your story, I'm sure.
Well, I think so. You know these monks, they wear these baggy habits. You know why? Because of their bad habits. That's what it's
for. Can you take your name, please?
Lenin.
What sort of things do you do as a lovely witch?
As a lovely witch? Well, I trained for 3 years in Glastonbury. We did vision quests, going in the woods, spell work, group work, working with energy, really.
I'm Tony Durant.
What are you doing here today, Tony?
I've been requested to come up here to do the audition for the wizard or witch for Wookiee Hole. And as you can see, I'm dressed as a wizard.
Magnificent outfit. Did you do that yourself?
Well, we managed to choose it. My manager, Sarah, here, she chose it. And the wigs and everything. So.
And I understand the bird impressions, is that the right term?
Yes.
Is your forte?
Yes, what would you like me to do?
Blackbird? What would be appropriate? A blackbird. Let's start off with a blackbird. Oh, you got to put your cane down, have you? Hold on. That's fantastic. Have you got anything very witchy? Can you do a raven or a crow? Or?
Yeah.
Stephen Morris in Wookiee Hole with the Wannabe Witches. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be uploaded at 7:30. Producing today, Francesca Panetta and Phil Maynard. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.